Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was hosted on Thursday, January 17, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum on federally owned real property in the Western States. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, Professor Donald Koshin and David Gerbet will be discussing Professor Koshin's article on the future of publicly owned lands. We'll begin with opening remarks from each speaker of about 10 to 12 minutes, with Professor Koshin leading off. Professor Koshin's paper can be found on the Federalist Society's website, and a link to the paper can also be found in the notice you received for today's call. Donald Koshin is professor of law at Chapman University School of Law in Orange County, California, where his scholarship focuses on law and economics, international law, property, jurisprudence, and more. David Gerbet is a staff attorney with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance in Salt Lake City, Utah, where his practice focuses on public lands law. With that, I will tell you that their fuller bios have been provided to you in the notice of this call and are also available on our website. So let's get started with Professor Koshin's opening remarks. Please go right ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you to all for joining us. There's a long history of wrangling between the federal government and the states, including Utah, over who should or does own or manage many lands in the western United States. Not surprising when you consider that 31% of the nation's lands are owned by the federal government, about 64% of the lands in Utah are owned by the federal government, and about 42% of Utah is managed by the Bureau of Land Management. The purpose of my remarks today is to discuss just one very recent development in this arena of land disputes, the March 2012 enacted Transfer of Public Lands Act, or HB 148, in Utah, and to describe the findings made in a white paper that Dean mentioned that I authored and that was published this January by the Federal Society, providing a legal overview of that law. I will make no attempt in this short time we have today, nor does the white paper tackle, resolving whether HB 148 is good policy regarding management or other objectives, nor even whether it will result in an increase in revenue that Utah seeks. Instead, I'm going to focus on the law. In a nutshell, the legislation passed in the state of Utah has demanded that the federal government extinguish title to certain public lands that the federal government currently holds, more than 20 million acres of federal public lands in the state of Utah, by December 31, 2014. It also calls for the transfer of such acreage to the state and establishes procedures for the development of a management regime for this increased state portfolio of land holdings. The state of Utah claims that the federal government made promises to it, at statehood when the federal government obtained the lands, that the federal ownership would be of limited duration, and that the bulk of those lands would be timely disposed of by the federal government into private ownership or otherwise returned to the state. I will proceed in three parts. First, I'll give you a bit more detail on the law itself. Second, I will explain the interpretation of the law in light of the promises made in the Utah Enabling Act. And lastly, I will briefly explain why the precedent to which some might seem to work against the TPLA and support broad federal powers is inapplicable to this legislation. The legislation has three main parts. The definitions set out in the TPLA establish the TPLA's scope by defining what is not included in the demand. It states that public lands means lands within the exterior boundaries of Utah, except, to one degree or another, private lands, Indian lands, lands held in trust for the state, lands reserved for state institutions, a few other lands with distinct ownership characteristics, and finally and most significantly, certain identified federally controlled lands in the state, including national parks, national monuments, wilderness, and several other special designation federal holdings. The heart of the TPLA is in the demand part, where the Act states, quote, on or before December 31, 2014, the United States shall extinguish title to public lands and transfer title to public lands to the state. The Act continues in its planning and management section to explain that if the state transfers title to any of these newly acquired public lands, the state shall retain 5% of the net proceeds that the state receives from any transfer of title that might occur and pay the remaining 95% to the federal government. The final portion of the Act calls for the creation of a Utah Constitutional Defense Council study to evaluate implementation strategies and develop legislation to plan for the state management of its soon-to-be-acquired lands. Now let's move into some analysis of the supporting authority for Utah's demand. I will focus on one such authority, a contract-based theory. A contract-based theory, including a compact-based duty to dispose, is one of the strongest arguments that proponents of the TPLA make to support the validity of Utah's demand. Utah's Enabling Act, I'll refer to it as the UEA, establishing its statehood was approved in 1894. The question becomes whether, one, inherent in the original compact, the UEA, the federal government accepted a duty to dispose of the public lands it acquired in that UEA. And separately, two, whether the state of Utah can enforce such a duty by demanding that the federal government live up to its obligation to dispose of such property into private hands. Longstanding precedents support the theory that the UEA is a bilateral compact that should be treated like it is a binding contractual agreement. It established the terms of the agreement and of entry into the union between the federal government and the new state of Utah. The critical provisions of the UEA for review are Section 3 and Section 9. The only appropriate way to read these provisions is to follow what the Supreme Court explained as a, quote, cardinal principle of contract construction, that a document should be read to give effect to all of its provisions and to render them consistent with each other, end quote. So we begin our analysis of the text of the UEA by looking at the relevant part of Section 3. Quote, the people inhabiting said proposed state do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right entitled to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof, and to all lands lying within said limits owned or held by any Indian or Indian tribes, and that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall and remain subject to the disposition of the United States. And it goes on a bit more. Section 3's forever disclaim language leads some to believe that Utah's case for upholding the TPLA is a dead letter. However, it must be read in context. First, even within this section, the language shows that the parties anticipate the title will at some point be extinguished. When opponents focus only on the forever disclaim segment of the UEA and say that this one sentence settles the case against the TPLA, they are improperly looking at only a part of the whole, an approach expressly rejected under the rules of construction recognized in courts. It was necessary to give in the UEA, the United States clean title and for the states to accept a duty of non-interference, one, so that the federal government could dispose of property with certainty of title, which would be necessary to attract market purchasers, two, so that in the first instance, the United States could directly realize and control the gains from those disposals, such that it could use the proceeds in accordance with its commitments made to the original states, such as paying off Revolutionary War debts. And three, so that because the United States would be successful in disposing of property to willing buyers at a full price, in other words, not discounted by uncertainty, the United States could sell at the highest price possible, which also benefited the state of Utah because they received a percentage of such sales elsewhere in the UEA, particularly Section 9. Thus, the state has a selfish interest in wanting the federal government to have certain title because it increased the state's own gains under the agreement. Consider Section 9 of the UEA, which provides, quote, that 5% of the proceeds of the sales of public lands lying within said state, which shall be sold by the United States subsequent to the admission of said state into the Union, shall be paid to the state to be used as a permanent fund, end quote, and then it goes on to talk about that permanent fund being for school purposes. First off, by its language, Section 9 entitles the state to proceeds from disposals. This means that the state is invested in and relying upon the existence of disposal, which, in consideration for this percentage of the proceeds, the state agreed to help facilitate those exchanges by disclaiming rights to the unappropriated lands so as to give the seller in the disposal market, here the federal government, the valuable commodity of certain title attached to the property disposed of. This interpretation is further strengthened by the words in Section 9 proclaiming that the land ceded in Section 3, quote, shall be sold. If the federal government could retain the property, the state would never get any benefit from Section 9. It is unreasonable to believe that the state intended to agree to disclaim rights in return for a cut of the sales of those lands, yet intended no corresponding obligation on the federal government to actually dispose of such lands. Now, moving along to distinguish cases that might appear to be against the TPLA. One difficulty with the public land precedents for deciding the validity of the TPLA is that, first off, the courts have had occasion to discuss states' obligations under compacts like the UEA, and in that process, courts have even contended that these are bilateral contractual agreements, meaning that they've recognized the federal government has some duties too, not just the states. But, secondly, the courts have had very little occasion to consider and discuss interpretations of the compacts which identify the duties imposed upon the other half of the bilateral agreement, the federal government. Thus, opponents of the TPLA invoke broad statements about federal power when the states overstep in relation to the compacts and call them precedents for the present case of the TPLA's legitimacy, even though the quote material is usually dicta. The major legal arguments against the TPLA rest on broad interpretations of the Property Clause in the United States Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, which provides, quote, "The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state." End quote. This is indeed a broad power, but not as broad as it might seem, and certainly not as broad as some portray it. We need to look at the language and prior decisions carefully, like a court should and a good court will. Unfortunately, that has not been the practice of those against the law. Consider, for example, what's called a legislative review note that was attached to the act by the Utah Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel, as required by legislative rules and practice in Utah. After citing the property clause, the legislative review note relies on statements in a few cases and concludes that, in light of these cases, and quote, "Under the Gibson case, that requirement in the HB 148 of the federal government to extinguish title would interfere with Congress's power to dispose of public lands. Thus, that requirement and any attempt by Utah in the future to enforce the requirement have a high probability of being declared unconstitutional." End of the quote. We only have time to discuss a couple of these cited cases, but the analysis is generally the same for each. Consider CLEPI, one of the cited cases. CLEPI simply holds that a state law allowing the state to come onto federal land and rustle up and later auction boroughs is unconstitutional because it interferes with federal management policies while the federal government is an owner of the public lands. The holding says nothing either in favor of or against giving Congress a power to ignore other commitments to dispose of property like the commitments it made in the UEA. The CLEPI holding simply maintains that while the federal government is an owner, states have a type of duty of non-interference with federally controlled lands, including refraining from passing laws that conflict with the federal policies while the federal government occupies these lands. If a state passes a law that so interferes, then it will be subject to conflict or other preemption doctrines, and the Supremacy Clause will indeed make the federal law control over the state one. But again, there was no need to grant Congress some truly unlimited property clause power to reach this holding in CLEPI. Therefore, such statements are dicta. In the CLEPI case, unlike in a challenge to the TPLA, there were no other relevant laws, comparable to, for example, the UEA, to consider other than the interfering municipal law that was invalidated. The legislative review note also quoted at length from U.S. Supreme Court's 1872 decision in Gibson versus Shoto, focusing on the claim in Gibson that, quote, "no state legislation can interfere with this property clause right or embarrass its exercise," end quote. Gibson only held that the state cannot interfere with a disposal, an incident to what might be called a duty of non-interference with disposal. It articulated that there is a prohibition on the state, quote, "depriving the grantees of the United States of the possession and enjoyment of the property granted by reason of any delay in the transfer of the title after the initiation of proceedings for its acquisition," end quote. The states couldn't mess around with the titles the federal government was granting to private individuals. The Gibson decision equates any measure a state takes to deprive the transferee of, quote, "the right to possess and enjoy the land," end quote, with, quote, "a denial of the power of disposal in Congress." While Gibson demonstrates that a state may not interfere with U.S. ownership or interfere with disposal, such as by adversely affecting the buyer's market for federal government property by creating discriminatory or disadvantaging rules on purchasers of federal government-disposed property, it does not speak to whether a state may nonetheless demand that the federal government follow through on promises made to the state to eventually dispose in some manner or another the property it holds rather than to retain it. We could here, and the white paper does, go on to discuss other cases, but the bottom line is that these cases are distinguishable from any review of the TPLA. Utah's Transfer of Public Lands Act presents fascinating issues for the areas of public lands, natural resources, and constitutional law, and I'm happy that we've had an opportunity to introduce it to you today. I look forward to Mr. Garbett's response and all of your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Koshin. This is David Garbett with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and I would just like to start by thanking the Federalist Society and Professor Koshin for organizing and hosting this call and for inviting me to participate. And I would like to say by introduction that House Bill 148, or the Transfer of Public Lands Act, seems as though it could provide, I think, an activist judge or court with an opportunity to legislate policy from the bench. However, that should not happen because House Bill 148 violates both the United States and Utah constitutions, as well as Utah's Enabling Act promise. It would overturn well-established precedent and upset an established system that all parties understand. And I think it's important, too, to mention that this is not really an argument about legal principles, at least House Bill 148. I think that it is fundamentally motivated not by legal equity, but the real motivator here is the control of resources and the venue for political decision making, and that such decisions are better left to be fought over in political arena, since we're talking about the resources of the American people as a whole, rather than leaving these decisions to the courts. But with that said, I'd like to address the white paper and some of these arguments that Professor Koshin has made. And I think his contract argument is very interesting. And so I'd like to take the bait, so to speak, and engage him on his contract law analysis. And to start, there are two important clauses that really motivate this discussion and motivate House Bill 148. And as Professor Koshin said, they are Section 3 and Section 9 of the Utah Enabling Act, the legislation passed by Congress inviting Utah to join the union and setting out the conditions for how that would happen and how that would look. They are, and those two clauses are found, one in Section 3 and one in Section 9. And let's just go over that language one more time. So the second clause of Section 3 says that the people inhabiting said proposed state do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof, and to all lands lying within said limits owned or held by any Indian or Indian tribes, and that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States. So that's Section 3. Section 9 says that 5% of the proceeds of the sales of public lands lying within said state, which shall be sold by the United States subsequent to the admission of said state into the Union, after deducting all expenses incident to the same, shall be paid to said state. Now, with both of these, I've just focused on the relevant language. But I think ignoring Utah's substantial promise to forever disclaim any right or title, which I think is a little hard to do, Section 3 says that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States. So again, ignore the important modifier here of until, which indicates that this clause is really about clarifying that the United States' position in the event of a title dispute with a state. But read this just as the title shall be extinguished. Section 3 tells us the title shall be extinguished under that interpretation. Next, Section 9 says, which shall be sold by the United States. And again, we need to ignore where this falls in the provision, since it comes after the introductory allocation of how land sale proceeds shall be divvied up. But with this interpretation, the contract indicates that the United States will one day extinguish title, and Section 9 clarifies that this will happen via land sales. So even under that reading, I still don't think that Utah could enforce such an interpretation, and I don't think they have a contract claim, and here's why. First of all, there's obviously no date certain in the contract. There's a complete lack of any indication as to a final date for when the land sale must be finalized or when these land sales must take place and when the United States must extinguish title. And then second, land sales are still taking place. The United States has sold and continues to sell federal land within Utah's boundaries. So how could a court determine that it has breached this contract? Although House Bill 148 sponsors may not like the time frame or the pace of such land sales, would it be appropriate for a court to invent a deadline or modify this process when the contract and history, I might add, of Utah and public lands contain no such term or provision? So I think one thing that often happens with House Bill 148 proponents is that land disposal and land sale are conflated. And I think that the white paper falls into this trap. Why do I say that? First of all, what is land disposal? I think land disposal is generally understood as things such as the Homestead Acts. These were a series of legislative acts that allowed, for example, homesteaders to take possession of the public domain if they met basic requirements such as being the head of a household or at least 21 and living on the designated land, building a home, improving that land, and farming for a minimum of 5 years, and then paying a basic filing fee. These laws then allowed for homesteaders to take possession of up to 160 or 320 or even 640 acres of land by meeting these requirements rather than, I would say, purchasing the land, for example, an auction. And there are other land disposal legislation that has been on the books in the United States. In 1976, Congress passed a law, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, which is often cited by House Bill 148 proponents as clear indication that land disposal was no longer the policy of the United States, and that is what has been the catalyst for much of this movement. But again, returning to the Utah Enabling Act, the Utah Enabling Act does not require land disposals, it requires land sale. So what are land sales? I think we should think of land sales as the traditional sort of real estate transaction that we envision when we talk about selling land. Land sales are authorized by the BLM on public lands by the Federal Land Policy Management Act of 1976. The Utah BLM develops land use plans for areas that it manages, for example, in this state. And these plans routinely identify lands for sale, and those sales do take place. Another example is of land sales that took place under the Federal Land Transaction Facilitation Act of 2000. By August of 2009, this legislation had resulted in $113 million in revenue from land sales on Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, land, including BLM lands in Utah. So land sales are taking place. That provision of the contract is being fulfilled. The rest of the Utah Enabling Contract has been fulfilled. There are quite a number of provisions and conditions in the Utah Enabling Act. For example, Congress sets requirements for the state of Utah to join the union, and those requirements include things like establishing a state constitution, providing for a Republican form of government. The federal government, in turn, makes promises to the state of Utah. Many of those promises are actually gifts of land that the federal government makes to the state, particularly for public education. This is a common provision that we see in many enabling acts. When states join the union, Congress would give states a section per township, and township was just a way to provide for land conveyance, identify real estate, but these are large blocks of land, 6 miles by 6 miles in size, and inside of every township you have 36 sections. The reason I'm explaining this is because when Utah became a state for the first time, Congress said, Utah, we will give you a very generous gift for your schools. We will give you 4 sections per township. Most states before that had only received 1 or 2 or even 3 sections per township. There were only 4 states that were given 4 sections per township, and Utah was the first one. So those portions of the Utah Enabling Act have been fulfilled. Now, House Bill 148 does not seek to remedy the supposed contract violation of a failure to sell land by requesting that the federal government sell the land. Instead, it asks that the federal government transfer the land to the state. So I don't see how the remedy matches the apparent violation. And then I think that an argument could even be made that Utah has not detrimentally relied on an expectation that land sales would take place. Essentially, the best Utah could do was submit that they had foregone spending from property tax revenues that they might have collected otherwise had the land been private. But I don't know that that would even fly. Utah has received substantial benefits from federal lands. For example, in 2011, mineral lease revenue sharing provided the state with $122 million. The federal government has created a program called Payment in Lieu of Taxes to make up for the fact that they do not pay property taxes. And in Utah, they gave the state $34 million in 2011. In addition, Utah does not pay for the management of these federal lands. And the lands at issue here cost the federal government in the ballpark of $225 million a year to manage. So I'm not sure that they could even argue detrimental reliance. And importantly, I would say that Utah did not necessarily expect that federal lands would all be sold or transferred. Now, the sources that are cited by Professor Koshin, I do not think reflect the historical setting for when Utah became a state. It's important to just quickly address how that happened. Utah became a state in 1896. Before that, the territory where Utah is found was acquired as part of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848 from Mexico. So this land was acquired by the federal government. It was federal territory. Utah was a territory at the time, Then in statehood at 1896, the federal government simply asked for clarification from the state that as it came into the Union, it was recognizing that this federal land that had always been federal land would stay federal land. In 1897, Utah's first forest reserve was created. That is 1 year after Utah was admitted to the nation. And why is that important? Well, public lands, or what we call public lands today, were previously the public domain. Public domain was available for things like land sales, land disposal. It was available for the Homestead Act. A forest reserve was an area that was reserved from acts such as the Homestead Act. It was reserved from the public domain. It was no longer available for disposal. So here was a clear indication from the federal government 1 year after Utah became a state that it was going to retain land, that it was withdrawing it from disposal, and that it was going to manage it. Similarly, in 1902, there was a Mormon Church Priesthood Conference on April 7th of 1902, where Mormon leaders voted to urge the federal government to withdraw from the market for protection all public lands in the watersheds above Utah cities. Now, I'm not suggesting that the Mormon Church sets policy for the state of Utah. However, what I am showing is that if an interest group that constitutes a supermajority in Utah at the time was urging the federal government to take action to retain, manage, and withdraw from disposal federal lands within Utah's borders, I find it hard for us to say now that there was always an expectation of land transfer. In fact, to the contrary, at this time there was, I think, a national movement for public retention of resources and land, and that's manifested by the creation of forest reserves and what eventually became the U.S. Forest Service. So that's just a quick thought on why, even under the contract theory, I think that Utah's claims under House Bill 148 would fail. But with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Professor Koshin for some discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Garbett. I appreciate all of your remarks and your careful reading of the paper, and I do hope that we'll have an opportunity to engage in greater detail on all of the points that you brought up at, you know, in other forums as well. I know that we only have a limited amount of time to sort of respond, and we do want to get to questions from the overall call base. But I do want to take a few moments just to mention some thoughts I have on a few of the points that you made. The idea that it would be judicial activism to interpret these obligations, I believe, is misfounded because of the fact that there needs to be some sort of remedy, and in fact, there's an indication in previous cases, including Andrus, that some remedy must exist for compact violations. And I think the courts have long recognized a need to provide a forum for that, particularly between the federal government and states when disputes arise. But secondly, as to the importance of the political arena, the political arena does have a role to play here, and one could be that the federal government in deciding how to respond to a demand such as Utah has made, whether or not the federal government would like to purchase property, make enclaves out of property within the state of Utah. It does not mean that the federal government must, that the only option is for the federal government to turn this property over to the state of Utah. They could certainly sell it into private hands, or they could find other constitutional means to retain ownership of that property. The second point that I wanted to discuss was your no date certain, and that the courts would need to invent a deadline. I think that courts are often placed in the position when there is an agreement and there is sort of an implied reasonableness of compliance that reasonable deadlines need to be set. And so the courts may find, I don't know how the courts would determine December 31st, 2014, whether or not that was the most reasonable, but I think that there is a point at which courts need to require that there at least be a showing of some movement that is sufficient to satisfy obligations such as would exist under the compact-based duty to dispose. And at the very least, the courts are in a position in which they can declare the existence of the duty and then afterwards determine what the deadline should be. As to the point about the detrimental reliance, I think that that's a factual inquiry, which I don't I've not developed in the paper, nor have I admittedly fully developed in my research either. However, at the same time, you don't get to detrimental reliance unless you're dealing with an estoppel type theory, and unless you're saying that there's no contract otherwise, and we're trying to enforce some promise that doesn't exist in the documentation. And I would contend that at least the conclusions that I'm reaching in my interpretation of the UEA is that the contract does exist. As to the Utah didn't expect the federal government to sell things off, and the sort of history of alternate actions that seem to indicate a willingness to retain possession, you're certainly going to find that. You're also going to find opposition to those actions that occurred both in Utah as well as states that were similarly situated throughout history, in which you have interest groups who opposed federal retention policies. And again, that material is not in the white paper, but it's certainly an area which I think, even if you can find anecdotal evidence of movements toward greater federal retention and control during the same time period at which they were making an agreement, I think the agreement would trump. So, but I do appreciate your comments, and I'd love to hear anything back from you, David. Otherwise,
let me just respond to 2 points or 3 points, and then turn it over for further discussion with our participants. First, I think the part of my argument is that Utah cannot show that this Utah Enabling Act promises as they would construct it, which I don't read the language that way, but they would say that the federal government has not followed through with its promise to sell land. But I would argue that there has not been a violation of that. The federal government is still selling federal land. Now, the disagreement is about the pace of land sales and perhaps the location, but they are still selling land. Second, I think it's really important to emphasize that Section 9, which talks about land sale proceeds in the Utah Enabling Act, is not the sum of obligations in the Utah Enabling Act. There are many other obligations, both for the federal government and for the state of Utah. The state of Utah did not give up its claims to federal lands within its borders simply because it was anticipating 5% of the proceeds from land sales. There are quite a few other provisions in the document that talk about land transfers, that talk about gifts of land to the state. So I think the state would have a very hard time coming into court and saying, look, we, in complete reliance on getting 5% of the proceeds from land sales, we gave this up. There were other benefits that were conferred to the state of Utah that it would not be able to dispute. And finally, again, going back to my historical evidence, the reason I pointed out the Forest Reserve from 1897 is to say that there were very clear indications from the federal government early on what the policy would be here in the state. And for Utah to come now in 2012 and to say to the federal government, hey, we don't think that you're fulfilling this contract, and it seems to us like we just realized you're not going to transfer this land, I think a court would have to consider something like the doctrine of latches that would prevent Utah from bringing these claims today when there was a clear manifestation from the federal government very early on that there would be lands that would not be transferred through disposition laws. So those are just a few quick thoughts, but I think we ought to open it up for questions.
Agreed.
Well, thank you both. This is Dean Reuter again. Let's do open it up for questions from the audience in a moment. Everyone should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we wait to see if we have questions from the audience, let me make our regular programming announcement. Next week, we'll be hosting Teleform calls on Wednesday and Thursday, at least at this point. On Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the Noel Canning case with Noel Francisco and Glenn Taubman. That is one of the key cases challenging the validity of President Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. And then on Thursday, also at 1 p.m., we'll be joined by Arthur Brooks, former head of the American Enterprise Institute, and he'll be discussing his new book, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. That's at 1 p.m. on Thursday. For a complete schedule of upcoming Teleform calls, please visit our website. Calls change quite often, and we're adding them at all times. We've got two questions on the board right now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button, and we'll get to your question in the order it's received. Let's go to the first caller.
Hi, my name is Bob Neugebauer. I'm with the Tea Party in Boise, Idaho. My question is for Mr. Gebert, and we have a problem basically with not just the forestry and the way the government takes care of our lands here, but we have had such intrusion with these forest fires, and you say they spend $260 million in Utah or on the forest themselves. Where is the stewardship that they're supposed to show to keep these lands the way they're supposed to be rather than allowing them to burn?
Bob, this is David Garbett. Thank you for that question. And I think your question is reflective of some of the comment and sentiment that we hear here in Utah from proponents of House Bill 148. And I think this, and I certainly understand where you're coming from, and I think this goes back to one of my points at the beginning, that House Bill 148, I think, fundamentally is a political disagreement, and it has to do with differences over how land should be managed. I can't speak to the specific situations that you are encountering in Idaho, but like I said, here in Utah, the bill sponsor, for example, when he talks about his legislation, he says part of the reason we need this is because of poor forest management here in Utah. I would disagree with him. I think his fundamental claim is that in Utah, the forest doesn't do the U.S. Forest Service and the federal government does not do a good job of managing forest resources because we have forest fires. Now, he doesn't go on to explain what his solution is to that, and I think it's one of two things. One, I say this only semi-facetiously, either we cut down the forests, all of them, so they can't burn, or we engage in practices such as selective logging. But logging in Utah is not an economic activity. As in, we cannot invite companies to come in and simply do selective logging without paying them money to do that. So the idea that the state taking over land and then paying parties to come in and selectively log will somehow save the state money, because this is, again, part of the argument for House Bill 148 is that poor federal land management is costing us all money. If we could manage it, it would be less expensive, and not only that, we would make so much money our schools would be awash in cash, and I don't find that supported in the evidence, and I think that having to pay companies to come in and cut down forests shows that instead this would be a money-losing proposition.
That may be your case down in Utah. That is not necessarily the case in places like Idaho, where we have had such bad air here for 2 to 3 months this year, people actually dying from the bad air. It's not just that, but we don't have to pay people to come in and selectively log here in Idaho because we've already been doing that for many years. The problem is opening up more of the forest where you have 200 or 300 trees to a certain segment. There really should be somewhere around 40 or 50 trees to a certain segment. There is no culling going on whatsoever, and nothing is being done with the underbrush. And we see this as a significant problem to all of our forest lands here. We go after the federal government and sue them for non-compliance with being good stewards of this land.
Well, again, I'm not as familiar with your specific situation, and I can't speak to Idaho. I would just say that here in Utah, I laid out the case. I think your position, again, is reflective of what is the fundamental motivator here, which is a difference in opinion about how resources should be managed, and there are other avenues for pursuing resolutions to those differences. I think rather than trying to rely on a claim that an enabling act promised that there would be no more federal land within a state's boundaries.
If I can say one thing, I rather than talk about necessarily the best management strategies, there is one point about the resolution of the legal status of the lands, and that is the states themselves lack the capacity to choose their own management strategies for these lands if they are not the owner of the lands. And so to the extent that the federal government is required legally to transfer the lands into state ownership, then I think the states would at least have that choice as to how to manage. Whereas it's a little bit different political fight because of the real positioning of the ownership interests that would change if there was a recognition of a duty to dispose.
Very good. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions at this point. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Representative Mike Noel from District 73 in Southern Utah. It encompasses eight counties. My question would probably go to Mr. Garbett from Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. One of the points that you made was that there are sales taking place. However, the type of sales that take place are very, very limited under the Federal Land Policy Management Act. These lands must be uneconomic to manage, isolated from other public lands. And with that type of scenario, how can you say that the federal government is fulfilling their promise to sell these lands when, in fact, the amount of sales that have occurred, especially in the last 10 years, has been reduced drastically? Exchanges also are in the Federal Land Policy Management Act. So where we have those SITLA lands that you talk about and that we got an extra section, many of those lands are in fact isolated, Section 2, 16, 32, and 36, in areas that have been made into quasi-wilderness areas under wilderness study areas where we do not get any economic advantage out of those lands. So we have been given something that we can't use, and again, it has hurt us. When you talk about this issue with the forest and how the management of the forest impacts income to the state, it not only impacts the forest lands, it impacts watersheds on private property, it impacts our receipts on private property within the forest, the fact that people now have a huge explosion of potential fire in areas where your organization, SUA, has precluded the cutting of dead and down trees because of forest beetles. So not only impacting just the public lands, it's impacting the forest, the private lands adjacent to the forest, and our ability to get full economic advantage. Utah, in fact, is spending 48% of our tax dollars on public education, as opposed to, say, New York State, which pays 24%. They are able to spend over $14,000 a year per student. We are the lowest in the nation because of the public ownership of lands in Utah. How do you respond to that?
Representative Noel, this is David Garbett from SUA. Thanks for calling in. I'm pleased that we've got a question from you. A few thoughts to your question. First, I would go back to my introduction to my remarks, which is that I was engaging in a contract theory response. And under contract theory, if the state of Utah's claim is that the federal government has violated its promise under the Enabling Act, and that promise, as I read the Enabling Act, as House Bill 148 would construe this, is that the federal government will sell land. Well, those land sales are taking place. And I said that proponents of the bill may not like the pace of those land sales, and they may not like the choice of those lands which are being sold, but they are taking place. So how could you go into a court and say, you know, this isn't happening, they're not selling land? Well, I think the federal government has a great argument that, yeah, we are selling land. Again, you may not like the acreage, and you may not like the pace at which we are doing this, but we are selling land. And if we take the plain language of the contract, they are fulfilling the contract. So I don't
Actually,
think
can I,
that
can
under...
I just start right there? My specific question, David, is that prior to October of 1976, land was being sold for many different purposes. You mentioned Homestead Act, Cary Act, lots of land. After FLTMA, the policy in the Land Policy Management Act is retention of the lands in public ownership, and only those lands that were uneconomic and isolated that could not be managed by the federal government would be sold. So they entered into a different policy that was in place prior to 76 and said, we're only going to sell those lands that we can't manage and that are isolated, we can't access. And that's the only lands that have been sold, David. That's all that's been sold.
Yeah,
so that's
again,
that's a whole different scenario than saying, well, we're still going along and selling, and we're not selling at a different pace. They changed the whole plan of how they're going, which lands they're going to sell, and said, we're not selling land unless the small part of land that can be that are isolated and uneconomic. So that's the issue right there. Not
yeah,
the
well,
fact
let, me,
that they're selling,
let me
they're
respond
not selling,
to that.
They're only selling what they want to sell.
Okay. Well, let me respond to that. I understand where you're coming from, Representative Noel, and I think what I've tried to point out is that the state of Utah's disagreement, in part, under House Bill 148 here, is motivated by a feeling that the federal land policy management in 1976, with its declaration that land disposal was no longer the policy of the United States and that acts such as the Homestead Act would no longer apply, is different than a contract law theory interpretation of House Bill 148. Now, I think that FLTMA, in declaring that it was no longer the policy that land disposals would take place, again, land disposal is a different issue than land sale. And under a contract theory, I don't think that that's a very strong argument to come in and say that Federal Land Policy Management Act has laid out a policy for no longer making the Homestead Act, which was not a land sale provision. Instead, it was a land grant provision. That's different than the contract theory, which would say there is a promise to sell land. I want to respond really quickly to two other points. I think that Representative Noel's complaints here are, again, very reflective of what I think is the fundamental basis of this argument. This is not really a legal theory argument. This is more about a disagreement over federal land management. I disagree with the comments that Representative Noel has made about forest management and what would be the best policy to pursue. But again, that's a policy disagreement between the two of us. And I would also add that he raised the point of how is Utah to fund its schools if we don't have massive amounts of private property. Well, in a way, that argument is a false argument. Utah does have a large amount of federal land, but we do have a relatively small population. And in terms of our population, the land base that is available for that population, so if you think of non-federal land on a per capita basis so that we can compare apples to apples, Utah is relatively well endowed with non-federal land. In fact, from my analysis, we are 21st in terms of the amount of non-federal land on a per capita basis. So we do relatively well on that front. And I've put forward suggestions. If Utah's serious about funding schools, there are ways to do that. Representative Noel, you can raise severance taxes. In fact, you could impose a severance tax on coal, which the state of Utah does not do. We lag behind our peers in terms of making effective choices in taxing resources to fund schools. But again, I think that's a side argument on these legal arguments.
This is Donald Koshin. David, I have to ask you, I think the sporadic and occasional land sales, even pursuant to some land sale programs, are still a bit of a distraction from the main argument that the federal government has, through a number of different initiatives, and FLTMA being one of them, taken the position that they claim plenary power pursuant to the property clause to choose whether to dispose, sell, grant, or otherwise retain the property that it currently holds. And I'm not sure that you would dispute that. That is the general tenor of the position that underlies whether they sell or not. There's not a recognition of a duty. In other words, the sales that are occurring right now are not being done pursuant to a recognition, well, we have a duty to sell this land. And so if they're continuing to believe that they have discretion to act and they're not making these sales as a matter of duty, then I think that we have, the sales that exist do not defeat the legal argument. The second thing that I would ask you is, would you be willing to have a duty, a determination made on whether there is or is not a duty, and then determine afterwards whether or not it was reasonably being complied with? In other words, if you're going to use the argument that they're meeting a duty right now, would you be willing to concede that they have the duty?
So this is David Garbett again in response. Those are good questions. And to be fair, that argument in part about land sales happening, I can understand your response on that end. But then I would go back to saying that I was conceding you the points that there may be a duty in the Utah Enabling Act. I want to take a step back and say I don't think that is the correct reading of the Utah Enabling Act. I think that we have to read that Section 3 and that Section 9 in context. And the way that I read them is that Section 3, it's very hard to swallow the language of Section 3, which says that the people of Utah forever disclaim a right or title to this land. Now, later on, there is a modifying provision which says until that title is extinguished or until that title shall be extinguished. I think that that should be read as a modifier, just saying that until the United States divests itself, Utah, you have promised you will never lay a claim to these federal lands. So I wouldn't stipulate that there is a contractual obligation to dispose. I was just saying that even if we did that, I think that they are meeting those provisions. Now, again, I go back to my argument about forest reserves in Utah in 1897 to say that this is another clear manifestation. So if we want to focus on FLTMA in 1976 and say, you know, oh, this was the first time that we understood policy, or we started to really put our minds around the idea that federal policy was retention, you've got a lot of climbing to do, because in 1897, the year after Utah became a state, the federal government took a significant action to show that it would be retaining and managing federal land. And I just don't see you getting over that argument by relying on FLTMA in 1976 to be the end-all, be-all of that manifestation.
No, I don't think that – this is Donald. I don't think that FLTMA was necessarily the first indication of that change or attempt to change in policy. I'm not trying to say that the earth changed, you know, in 1976. But but I think that there's been federal overreach at various points in time, including perhaps at the time that the Forest Reserve was created.
Mm-hmm. This is Dean Reuter. Let me interject and ask each of our presenters, do you have a hard stop on the hour at 3 o'clock Eastern time? We've got just a few minutes left. The switchboard's lighting up now with four callers who have questions. Do we need to end promptly on the hour?
This is David. I do not.
Okay. All right, now we've got five questions, so let's go to the next question, and I'm going to advise the callers to try and be as brief as possible, and please ask questions rather than make statements. Thanks.
Hello, Professor Cosen. I have not read the paper, but I was just wondering, as a law student who's taking property now, would it be something that you could just present the action through in terms of the UEA contain a de facto land sale contract which improperly failed to specify the date of transfer of the federal land, and that the court could interpret a reasonable time should have been applied to the contract, it didn't, that the government's overdue, and that specific performance could be ordered?
I think that's a reasonable expectation of the court's role. That is, the court has done that in similar situations in which there's a missing term, and where there is at least some indication, and we can find it throughout the document, that there would be an anticipation of timely compliance. The court has talked about timeliness in relation to school grant lands and other parts of compacts, and so the courts have found that timeliness factor to come into play in complying with other portions of different state compacts, despite its absence. So I think you raise a very good point.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to the next question. Now four questions pending.
Hi. I was wondering, why doesn't the state of Utah try to seize these lands using eminent domain? Now, I know that the federal law is supreme, but is there actual federal law that says these lands must maintain in the property of the federal government, or did they just federal law to transfer the property at one time? These aren't federal enclaves, so the Utah still has jurisdiction over these lands, right?
This is Donald Koshin. There actually was legislation in 2010 attempting, as far as I understand it, I've not done a detailed analysis of it within the state of Utah, based on that sort of eminent domain-based theory. And I think it's quite a different theory and would require a different legal analysis than what we've done here as to whether or not that would be legitimate. I think that there is, you know, there are high supremacy clause hurdles in achieving that. And despite the fact that you have, recognized that, the law recognizes that there can be some jurisdiction of Utah, even in lands that are federally controlled or federally owned, I don't know that that somehow changes the eminent domain analysis, which generally there's a debate over the extent of a state's power of eminent domain vis-a-vis federal lands, at least, that still lurks out there that's not resolved.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Yes, this question is for Mr. Garbutt. This is Jerry Steglitz, Daga County Commissioner. My question is a comment you made referring to PILT monies as part of the payment in lieu of taxes to states and counties. I'm curious to see what your suggestion is, what it's going to replace them with, the budgetary constraints that are coming down from Washington. Our PILT monies are diminishing and they're due to go away in a year. What's your solution to that in the whole scheme of things?
Well, thank you for the question. This is David. Just to be brief, I don't see PILT payments going away. I think they'll continue to be dispersed. That's my take.
Okay, let's go to the next caller.
Great presentation, gentlemen. I missed the very first few minutes of the call, so maybe you addressed this, but the question I have relates to what problem it is that we're attempting to address. To phrase it this way, I'd paraphrase the great joke that circulated some time back, "Hello, Utah, I'm from the federal government, and I'm here to help you." Assuming that the contract case is weak, how do we get the federal government to divest itself of substantially all or a large part of its the public domain that it claims? I assume that both presenters do agree on that goal. Is that assumption warranted?
This is David Garbutt. I'll take a first crack at that. Thanks for the joke. No, I don't agree with that assumption. I do not think that the state of Utah should take possession of the vast majority of federal lands here in the state. As I said before, I feel like this is a political disagreement, and it's a political disagreement motivated by control of resources and where the venue is for determining how those resource decisions should be made. And to be frank with you, in the state of Utah, I feel like I have no voice for participation in land management, whereas on the national level, I think that there is more opportunity and there is more of a voice for everyone to participate in public lands management. So I would not like to see these lands transferred to the state.
This is Dean Reuter. David Garbutt, would you prefer federal management over private ownership as well?
Yes.
Okay. Donald, I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
Yes, this is Donald Koshin. If you are assuming that that there is not a legal argument, was I think what you said, if there's not a legal basis to demand that the federal government has some duty to comply with disposal of the property into either private or state hands, then you are left with your political processes in which, again, you have to resort, return to who is the better manager. The idea that states traditionally control property within states, and it is, that there's some argument, at least from a broader policy perspective, that states should have that control because they're close and intimately aware of the problems that are close to the state and within its jurisdiction. And so you have your traditional sort of policy-based federalism concerns that can be advanced. At the same time, you have had a growing federal government for, decades, and it is difficult to see the federal government voluntarily, without some legally imposed duty, giving up much land. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you've seen, a resort to making sort of a demand based on the legal side.
This is David Garbutt. If I could just clarify one thing really quickly. I was asked whether I would prefer federal management over private management, and I said federal, but I should amend that to say it depends on who the private owner is. If it's me, sure, I would prefer my ownership. But then quickly, let me just respond on that theory of of the more appropriate land manager. It is often said that Utah would be in a more effective place to manage lands in the state because we're located closer to them. Well, that's not really the case. The federal land managers that typically make on-the-ground decisions are located in the communities where these decisions are made. What this is really about is who are those managers ultimately responsive to? And at the state level, those managers are ultimately responsive to a much smaller pool. It's only to the political structure here in Utah, whereas federal land managers are responsive to a larger entity, essentially responsive to the nation as a whole and to the political structure there. So I think it's really about a difference in opinion and a difference of where those benefits are conferred in terms of how the land is managed, not necessarily that one entity is more effective or efficient than another.
We still have two questions pending. Let's go to the next caller.
This is R.J. Smith with the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and I see a more fundamental problem facing the nation, and that is the extent of government land ownership at all levels. I mean, you have local, county, state, and federal government. Total land ownership is approximately 50% of all the land in America, and it's still increasing. And I think this raises serious problems in the future for the maintenance of a free society if government owns a lion's share of the land and the resources, because you're sort of on a slippery slope to some form of green feudalism. And I think it's in the long run, I think it'll be better for the nation and better for management of our wildlands, of our resources, of our wildlife, and so on, if we begin to find ways to transfer this to some from the federal government to the state governments, but overall more out of government ownership and into private ownership. And this doesn't mean just putting everything up for highest bidder. But we have long traditions in this country of private ownership and management of forest, of wildlife, refuges, of parks, of monuments, and so on. And I think you could find ways. I think the nation would be better off and the wilderness would be better off. For instance, if the Wilderness Society owned wilderness areas and they paid all the management costs, bore all the costs, and were responsible for the protection of the forest, of the wilderness areas. I mean, same thing for forest areas and same thing for grasslands and wildlife refuges. The National Audubon Society for over 100 years has managed its own wildlife refuges and done a far better and far more efficient job than the federal government. And I wonder how you look at that. I mean, that's really the radical end of the land question, but I think it's an important issue. And I do think that these private groups that care about wetlands and care about forests and care about wilderness areas would be far better owners and managers of these resources than government is.
This is Dean Roy. Before we get an answer to that, let me let you know that our final questioner dropped off. So this is the final question. So if in answering you want to take an opportunity to wrap up as well, why don't you do that? And with that, David Garbett, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. So this is David Garbett. Let's do it. That's a good question, and I understand the theoretical arguments that you are making. I think your argument points to another flaw here in House Bill 148, because although at times proponents of House Bill 148 and the Utah Land Transfer Act cloak their arguments in the theory that private land management may be better for us than public land management, their actions do not reflect that. What their actions reflect is that this is really a dispute about who should be calling the shots. The state is not asking the federal government to sell the land. The state is asking the federal government to transfer the land to the state of Utah. And then subsequent to that, the state is designing policies or measures for how it will manage the land. So I think that shows this is really a dispute about who's calling the shots. It's not a dispute about theoretical. Closing, I would say thanks again for this discussion. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you for all of the questions on the call. It's been a pleasure to do this. I think that there are certainly interesting questions that come up from House Bill 148, but I think fundamentally it's flawed, both on a constitutional basis, and when I say that, I mean the United States and the Utah Constitution, and on a contract theory basis.
Donald Koshin, final thought?
Yes, thank you. This is Donald Koshin. I agree, Mr. Smith, that there are many instruments to achieve societal objectives, and those instruments can be, you know, through private mechanisms, private control, as well as private conservation measures, some of which, you know, are designed to maintain their conservation status and protected by the law as such. We should not presume that public ownership is going to be the only way that we can achieve the natural values or other values. It does lead to sort of, if we start presuming that we need to keep everything that the public owns, then we are at risk of, you know, not having the proper allocation of those resources. And that doesn't just mean to the highest and best developer, but indeed to the best manager of those properties for whatever their capacities should be. As to David's point about the bill, I do think that at least if there is a deadline set such as December 31st, 2014, the federal government has every ability to dispose of whatever property and sell whatever property it wants between now and whatever deadline that might be before it transfers it over to the state. So there's still an opportunity for the federal government to, A, purchase property itself, create enclaves itself, and to therefore retain federal ownership in a proper manner. The second, and then of course the state would get some benefit from the proceeds of those choices. And B, the federal government could choose to, if appropriate, dispose of the property into private hands before that deadline as well. Now, as to once it were transferred into state hands, I do think that as far as the questioner, Mr. Smith's point goes, to the extent that there is any desire to have some movement into private hands, it can only occur if there is some movement toward controllers of the property who have at least a willingness to create a market for acquisition of such properties. And I think at least given the current policies and stated policies of retention by the federal government, they are not likely to create that market for acquisition. So with that said, I do think you made some interesting points about who should manage, and we need to consider not only the different levels of public management, but also the different types of private management, even for natural resources purposes. So thank you to all who've had great questions, and to the Federal Society for hosting this call, to David Garbett for agreeing to participate and for engaging in this thoughtful discussion. And I hope that we will continue to discuss these issues. I do think that if you look carefully at the law, if you look carefully at the promises that were made in the original Utah Enabling Act, you will see a number of promises on a contract-based or compact-based theory that need to be fulfilled, that there is a duty to dispose of these properties. At the very least, too, I hope that people will read the white paper for purposes of engaging in the discussion on precedent and understanding that some of the cases which are being cited to say that the federal government has this absolute power over these properties just simply are not as extensive when you break them down and look at what is dicta and what is precedent, and you can start to see that the debate at least needs to be on a different ground than just citing one-liners about clear unconstitutionality. And I hope that this call, the white paper, as well as future conversations will continue to allow all of us to explore the correct approach.
Well, thank you very much. This is Dean Reuter again. I want to thank both Professor Donald Koshin and David Garbett for joining us today for longer than originally anticipated. You more than fulfilled your obligation, so thank you both very much for joining us. A reminder to our audience that the white paper we've been discussing, Donald Koshin's paper, is available on the Federalist Society website, and there was a link provided in the notice you received to today's call as well, so you can get to it that way as well. And further to our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call next Wednesday at 1 p.m. when we'll be looking at the National Labor Relations case, Noel Canning, and in particular the argument over President Obama's recess appointments to that board. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. Until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast.
For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.